I'd like to call to order the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. First, we have a quick organizational meeting for purposes of adopting rules.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Senate Education and Workforce Development Committee rules dated February 1st, 2012.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2012. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. And now I would like to open up an informational hearing on Senate Bill 1581 and Senate Bill 1538, so that people could talk about both if need be. And we are honored today to have Governor Kitzhaber joining us to speak and testify on Senate Bill 1581. Governor Kitzhaber, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon, and I'm very honored to have the chance to come down here today. I am particularly delighted to see Dr. Senator Steiner Hayward up there, and feel that having another doctor in the House is always a good thing. I'm here to testify on House Bill 1581. Last session, as you know, I signed more than 25 pieces of legislation that dealt with education, and at least two of those I think will make an enduring contribution to our goals to transform our system of public education to better serve students and to enable them to achieve their full potential in a challenging and changing world. Senate Bill 253 created our 40-40-20 goals and our goals for a college and high school completion. And Senate Bill 909, as you know, laid out a strategy to achieve those goals by building a seamless educational system from early childhood through college and careers, by changing the state's role in financing education from that of a passive funder to that of an active investor. With Senate Bill 1581, the Oregon Education Investment Board has laid out the strategies to move that vision forward. It should be clear to all of us from last week's news about high school graduation rates that we don't have any time to lose in moving these strategies forward. A 67% high school graduation rate is a far cry from our ambitious goal of 100% high school graduation by 2025, but next year's class of kindergartners is the high school class of 2025, and we can't let any more time go by to put in place strategies and plans to establish a trajectory for student success. One of those strategies, as I said, is to design and organize a seamless system of coordination and support for all of our educational institutions across the 20-year educational continuum. Today, there is no one agency in state government or no single educational officer who is charged with the responsibility of overseeing the P20 continuum. That will change, of course, when we hire our chief education officer, but before then, we need to give that position the authority to bring all the functions of education together and to align them to free up resources for students, teaching, and learning in our institutions. So providing that authority for the chief education officer is one of the central purposes of Senate Bill 1581. The other part has to do with investment and accountability, and these are the elements you'll find in the board's request for the use of achievement compacts. To focus state funding where we know it will be most effective, to get all of our educational institutions aligned around a common set of outcomes and work in concert to achieve our educational objectives and our 40-40-20 goals and our path to career in college, to learn from what's working best in our schools and disseminate best practices throughout our educational system, to accelerate our commitment to student success for all students by closing the achievement gap, and finally to develop a culture of continuous improvement in our schools and in our communities. I think we all recognize that these are very challenging times, and I've been asked on more than one occasion how we expect to move the needle on the dial of student achievement while continuing to squeeze our educational budgets. I recognize that challenge, and it's very clear to me that our system of public education is underfunded at all levels, from early childhood through post-secondary education, and at the end of the day, we will not be able to achieve our our educational attainment objectives without additional resources. But I also know that we see 197 different school districts out there that have their needle at different places on that achievement dial. And some of those districts are doing better than others with for their students, even students in poverty. With roughly the same funding. And so my point is, even as we continue the debate and seek ways to reinvest in our system of education, we also need to learn from those districts that are standing out, that are beating the odds, if you will, encourage their efforts towards student success and try to share that information so that we can get all the needles and all the dials pointed in the same direction. Senate Bill 909, as you know, asked us to bring these recommendations to this session of the legislature. You recognized, I think, the urgency of this effort in establishing this deadline. We didn't know then, as we do now, that there is yet another reason for establishing a new system of accountability in the upcoming school year, and that is our efforts to achieve a waiver from No Child Left Behind. Our waiver request, which Ben Cannon can describe to you in more detail, hinges on the use of these achievement compacts. And with your approval, we'll be able to move beyond the strictures of a system that will label many of our most innovative and successful schools as failures, that will shift to innovations and interventions that are based on what actually works and can be tailored to the needs of individual students. And that will help us focus on the best use of 100% of our school budgets on 100% of the students, not just the 3% of our students who are in federal Title I programs. Already, this focus on achievement compacts, this focus on 40-40-20 has sparked some very productive and encouraging conversations throughout the state. In Pendleton, for example, Head Start teachers and kindergarten teachers are meeting together for the very first time. Quite remarkable. It's fostered discussions between teachers and administrators and other parties throughout the state in a common effort to build a collaborative approach to a better pathway from high school to college and university success. I think the value of these discussions that have been stimulated is evidenced by the agreement around a set of amendments that will be offered by my staff later today between the Oregon Education Association, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and the Oregon School Board Association. So in short, I believe that these steps that we are hoping to be able to take with your approval are the right steps for students, are the right steps for education, are the right steps for our economy, and are the right steps for Oregon. And I urge you to give us approval to move this plan forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Any quick questions? Senator Beyer.
Governor, I really appreciate the work you've done on 909 and putting the new direction. I think that the direction's the right one, and we're going in rather a fast pace for a state government legislature. I do have a couple of concerns, and one is really with the work I think we did last time. We took some right steps, but we also created some duplication in terms of I think we have like four different statewide panels now overseeing higher ed, for example. And just strictly from an organizational management thing, the language in the bill in 1581 that talks about the chief investment officer having direction and control for over all of these positions for matters related to design of the education organization, I'm a little concerned that that's going to create a conflict between who's the boss. Frankly, you know, you've got some of the institutions reporting to one board for one thing and to this one. I guess where I would like to see us end up is if we're going to go this direction, let's centralize that a little bit more. So I guess that's a concern. And the other thing I'd just like your comment on, and it's more, as you know, I've been working a lot on the higher ed system, and I just would kind of like to hear your thoughts on independent boards for the seven university campuses to the extent that they choose to have one.
Oh, yeah. I'm enormously surprised at that second question, Senator Beyer, but I'll
I thought it'd be a surprise.
Let me take the first one first. The intent here, I think there will be some conflict. There are duplicative reporting lines. It is a bit confusing. And the authority that we're seeking for the chief education officer, that is the control and direction, is solely for the purpose of developing a governance recommendation that will be brought back to the legislature in 2013. And we've given clear direction that we want form to follow function. Well, first of all, we want to start and ask ourselves, what are the functions that we want these different elements of our educational system to achieve, and then walk backward from that and design the best governance structure to do that. And I think we're going to end up with fewer boards and commissions and a clear line of authority and accountability. On the second question, I am very supportive of the concept of independent boards. I was very engaged as Senate President and then as Governor in the development and implementation of the legislation that created the independent board for the Oregon Health Sciences University, which I think has been a tremendous success in terms of making that a world-class educational and research institution. I think the two campuses, currently the two institutions in our post-secondary system that are most ripe for that are the University of Oregon and Portland State. I think that Oregon State University is a land-grant university, has a different charge and set of missions. I haven't heard President Ray express an interest in moving in that direction. So if you recall trajectory, which was being pursued by former President LaRiviere, was to essentially have an independent board for the University of Oregon by 2013. It wasn't to do it in 2012, just for the record. I believe we're still on that trajectory. I'm very supportive of an independent board for the University of Oregon. I have drafted a letter and sent that to Paul Weinhold at the Alumni Association to that effect, and we'll continue to support that. My only question is a capacity question. The bill that created the OHSU independent board was 40 pages long and took about 2 years to put together, and there's a series of legitimate questions that I think simply need to be worked out, not to slow the process down, but to be deliberative, that have to do with everything from hiring and firing the president to a bonding capacity, to who owns the building, to who sets tuition, to what is the relationship between collective bargaining units and PEB. So I know that there is a piece of legislation moving here that moves us in that direction, and I will certainly sign whatever you guys bring to my desk, but I will, whether you do or not, I will continue to pursue a trajectory to achieve an independent board for the University of Oregon by next year.
Governor, I appreciate the comment. I guess since you were sort of in the driver's seat when we did in 95 the Oregon Health Sciences University thing, don't you think that a lot of those questions, and in fact a pattern, we've already developed and have codified in the statutes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Barr, I think that's true, although the codification of those languages as it pertained to OHSU were the product of an inclusive process that included the stakeholders who were directly affected, from the employees to the students. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it may look similar, but it's not the same animal as a big research university with a medical school. The University of Oregon is a different entity, and I think you will find, probably even in this session, that groups that have a stake in this are going to want to have the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation, and whether you can get that done by next Monday, which I think is your deadline for hearing a bill, would take the whole idea of a nimble, fast-moving government to a new level. And I guess, I like your question, because those who are saying that we're going too fast with Senate Bill 1581, you're talking Warp 8 here, and we're talking Mach 2. So
I guess the goal would be, I like that. I've never thought we could do it in 2012. I thought we could start the process, but if I'm hearing you right, you think we can get it done by 2013.
I do. It's certainly up there, Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Governor, for sharing with us. I have two questions. One has to do with the lines of authority between the governor, the respective boards, and the boards who, when I see the language, which is present language, those commissioners or the chancellor serve at the pleasure of the board. What's your expectation for how that line of authority would work? Is there any consistency in the part of the bill, Section 1, and where the language exists that those offices serve at the pleasure of those respective boards. That would be one question. The other would be to elaborate a little more on the achievement compacts and the role of collective bargaining in those compacts, because the bill is silent with respect to that issue.
So the first question, I don't have the bill in front of me, Senator, but the lines of authority would be that the governor would appoint the members of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and those members would have to be confirmed by the Senate, and then the board would hire the chief education officer, and that would be the individual for the lines of reporting for the different elements of the system. So the Early Learning Council, whatever, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission would report directly to the chief education officer.
And then, just to follow up, with respect to termination, language very clear that in the event of a dispute, the governor's decision is final and binding. And so I'm wondering how that fits with the respective authorities of the boards.
Okay, so, and again, this maybe we need some coordinating language. My intent, and I can't speak for the rest of the OEIB, would be that the OEIB would be the hiring and firing entity for the members of the, what morphs into the chancellor or the head of the community college and workforce commission. On the second question, the set of amendments that have been drafted that involve the three educational associations, I believe attempted, and they can speak for themselves because they're all right behind me, attempted to address the legitimate concerns about engagement and consultation in the development of the achievement compacts, my understanding it is not related to collective bargaining in the sense that we bargain for wages and benefits.
Thank you. Just one final comment, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I really like your tie, Governor.
Thank you.
It is so appropriate for today.
It's also 25% of my tie collection.
Well, I recognize it as a Boys and Girls Club
tie. Yes, it is. Yes.
And that's one of my favorite ties as well.
Very good.
Thank you.
I'll be glad to give it to you if you vote. Transactional politics at its worst.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor Kitzhaber, if this question is not most appropriately directed to you, feel free to defer it. One of my concerns is that we're asking this chief education officer to oversee an extraordinarily wide range of educational endeavors, from the day our children are born till the day that they get through at least their 2 years of post-secondary education. And I wonder how we're going to ensure that the person who fills this role has appropriate expertise to work well with all the relevant people who are reporting to him or her. And if it's not the right time for you to comment on it, that's fine, but it is a concern of mine.
So, Senator Steiner Hayward, we are in the process of a national search. We have a search committee. I think Hannah Vandering is a member of that search committee, can maybe speak to this in more detail, but we have created a sort of a job description, and you're right, we need a superwoman here, I think, to make this work, but there are a number of attributes we're looking for. These individuals will be screened, and ultimately the Oregon Education Investment Board will have to make that decision. But I think it's also important to recognize that on the front end, we need someone who's got great leadership skills, who is a systems thinker, who is very collaborative. But the OEIB eventually, ultimately, will be actually making the policy, and this individual actually will be implementing the policy, and will have the support, of course, of expertise in early childhood through post-secondary education. But we think this decision on who this individual is going to have a huge impact on the success or failure of the effort.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Governor, thank you for coming down
here
and talking to us about this. Appreciate your leadership on this and your willingness to be flexible in the language as we have been. This is an informational hearing. The reason it's an informational hearing as opposed to a more public and legal public hearing is because procedurally we don't have the bill yet. We just started today and it's not over here yet. There will be a full public hearing next Wednesday on both of these bills, and on next Wednesday I hope to move both of these bills to the Senate floor. So, having said that, Tim Nesbitt from the governor's office is here with panel, our team, to go over the details of this in a section-by-section breakdown, and you have some amendments from the original LC.
We do, Senator.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt, manager of the Oregon Education Investment Project and staff to the Oregon Education Investment Board. I'll let my co-panelists introduce themselves as we get to their testimony, if that's okay. As the governor mentioned, we have amendments. Actually, what we have is an outline and summary of amendments I'd like to walk through with you. But first, I understand you would like us to walk through again the provisions of Senate Bill 1581 as printed in that bill. We did so when this was in LC form at your hearing here on January 20th. So I will cover that ground again and then spend a little more time going over the amendments with you. In Section 1 through 13 of Senate Bill 1581 relate to the Chief Education Officer. In Section 1, you'll find defined the, quote, direction and control authority proposed for the Chief Education Officer. This is language that comes from Senate Bill 909, and it is one of the questions posed for the Investment Board to answer in their report to you. Their answer is not to create expansive direction and control authority that includes that includes the appointing authorities or changing the appointing authorities that currently exist, but in this instance to give the Chief Education Officer direction and control over the other education officials listed here for matters related to the design and organization of the state's system from early childhood through college and career, the so-called P20 system. Yeah, in the governor's answer to Senator Morse a few moments ago, he was referring to the long-term prospect that we expect to address in legislation that the board expects to bring to you in 2013 about how this P20 system would be better designed, focused on its form and function, be more streamlined, and another directive from the governor, which I'll share with you when we talk about Senate Bill 1538, is to ensure that we come up with one entity that oversees the university system, not more than one. In the interim, in 2012, this legislation gives to the Chief Education Officer that more limited direction and control authority to work with those other officials, not to change the lines of appointing or hiring and firing authority, to work with those other education officials on organizing, on designing and organizing this system of state support coordination for the P20 continuum from early childhood through college and career readiness, which right now spans the agencies of the Department of Education, the Community College and Workforce Development Department, as well as the university system, including the Chancellor's Office. Section 2 clarifies that the Chief Educational Officer's authority does not apply to any Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction appointed by the incumbent superintendent, thereby clarifying that reference to the Deputy Superintendent would result in a different effect once the current superintendent's tenure is completed and there is a deputy appointed by the governor. So we have to be prospective in terms of our reference to those positions and clear about no application to the current positions. Sections 3 through 12 simply contain the language changes needed to conform existing statutes governing the positions listed to the Chief Education Officer's authority in regard to designing and organizing the P20 system. And then Section 13, similar to Section, I think it's 19 later on, is necessitated by the existing sunset date for the Oregon Education Investment Board. Sections 14 through 19 relate to achievement compacts. Section 14 defines achievement compacts and the education entities with whom the board will enter into those compacts, makes the timeline for adoption of the compacts coincident with the district's budget adoption timeline by June 30 of this year, describes the categories of outcomes to be contained in the compacts, and directs the education entities who will be parties to these compacts to identify the targets and quantify them for outcomes to be achieved in a given fiscal year or school year, and requires communications with key constituencies before entering into achievement compacts. This section also authorizes the OEIB to specify the format of the compacts and set the timeline and method for year-end reports on the achievement of results represented in the compacts. Section 15 allows the board to waive laws and compliance reporting generally for education entities that are party to the achievement compacts. We noted when we were here on January 20th that there was amendment needed there, and I'll cover that in the amendments shortly. And it also specifies that the Board of Education shall waive Division 22 reporting requirements, something the board and the department have already done for the current fiscal year or school year for K-12 districts that entered the compacts in 2012-13 fiscal year. So that waiver of reporting requirements, but not compliance with the provisions of Division 22, is intended here for another year for those districts which enter into achievement compacts. There's a further section here which is intended not to penalize an education entity for not filing a Division 22 report, but goes farther than that and says they would not be penalized for not complying with Division 22. We're proposing to clarify and change that in the amendments I'll note for you shortly. Section 16 is, again, related to the sunset date of the investment board. Section 17 gives the investment board the authority to enter into and administer the achievement compacts. And then Sections 18 and 19 repeal the authority of the board to enter into those compacts consistent with the 2016 sunset date. Section 20 is the standard emergency clause. I have provided to you an outline and summary of amendments that we have developed in consultation over the last month with the Oregon School Boards Association, the Confederation of School Administrators, Oregon Education Association, and others. And before I walk through these amendments, I also want to note that last night we completed the seventh of seven community forums around the state, where we have showcased the board's report, talked about this legislation, had great participation from members of the community, from our early childhood educators and parents, from teachers in the K-12 system, from educators and students, both in the K-12 system and the community college university system. We had over 1,000 participants in the in our seven meetings, and we also did a webcast to provide an eighth forum. With board members present at all of them, we are very much focused on continuing to refine how these compacts will look based on the framework provided in the legislation. This legislation is intended to give you a clear picture and the board a clear picture of what the achievement compacts will contain, and we will further work to refine those between now and the end of March, when we expect to be distributing them to the education entities, to the school districts, to be completed before June 30th. That work will also include gathering the data already existent from the Department of Education, where we'll actually be able to fill in the first column of the achievement compact we showed you at your January 20th meeting, where the data is known for the prior school year, helping to frame the target setting that district boards will do for the coming school year. With that, I want to outline for you what is on this list of seven amendments. The actual drafting of them is yet to occur, and we expect that that'll be happening the remainder of this week. Number one is in response to the question that Senator Beyer asked on January 20th and touched on again earlier today. And that is, why not have achievement compacts between the investment board and each of the universities? With this amendment, that's exactly what we'll do. On item 2 and item 3, you heard reference when we presented to you on January 20th to how we might relate to the work of the Quality Education Commission and be informed by the quality education model. These two amendments will specify that the investment board work with the Quality Education Commission to identify best practices at the district level and estimate the costs and benefits of their adoption on a broader scale, and also require that each achievement compact show where the district stands in its level of funding vis-a-vis the QEM funding, the QEM's optimum recommended funding level. In item 4 here, we list for you those cleanup amendments that we mentioned again on January 20th regarding the intent that we're waiving a reporting requirement. We're not waiving the compliance with the underlying regulations. This is intended to be a relief from paperwork, not exemption from compliance with these provisions. And finally, we are calling out our interest, something we've talked about with the superintendents and representatives of school boards, to suspend or minimize the continuous improvement plan requirements now in statute, which relate in large part to federal requirements, so there's only so far we can go there, but consistent with federal and state law, we'd like to have the achievement compact process replace what's now this continuous improvement process. The objectives here are the same, to improve teaching and learning and reach higher levels of achievement for our students. On item 5, you will see language which we attached, which reflects the input from educators through the Oregon Education Association, American Federation of Teachers, the Confederation of School Administrators for the administrators, and the Oregon School Boards Association for a framework for a process of the kind that Superintendent Nancy Golden described to you when we were here on January 20th. And maybe making just a few comments, I want to then ask Nancy to give you her sense of how this fits into the work that she has done in her district already on preparing a sample achievement compact. In particular, I think the governor clarified for you that this does not create a bargaining process. It creates an achievement compact committee that is intended to achieve collaboration at the district level. The key to success for the achievement compacts will not be the setting of targets so much, as valuable as that is, but the achievement of results focused on those targets. And the involvement of educators and community members will be critical in the achievement of success in this regard. So this outlines a process for that for our K-12 schools and indicates that for post-secondary, as well as for associations representing educators, employees of these districts, and administrators and governing board members, that we want to hear more from them by September of this year on how collaboration might be better enhanced and how these achievement compacts may reach their best potential with the involvement of educators. And that's what subsection C and D provide. With that, I have a couple more to cover, but I think at this point it would be good if Superintendent Nancy Golden can tell you a little bit more about how this relates to the work she described to you at your January 20th hearing.
Okay. Dr. Golden.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Golden, Superintendent of Springfield Public Schools. Do you push it down?
I'm going to hand your hand out, Chair.
What'd you say?
Your hand out.
My hand out. Oh, okay. Senator Haas.
And then push it down, too.
Push it down too? No. You're confusing me. Members of the committee, I want to talk a little bit about how we make sure as we move on achievement compacts, we're collaborating with all of the important people who are going to make sure these achievement compacts get implemented in a way that we do achieve the 40-40-20 goals. I want to say in the community forum, the 7 of them, I was at one of them, but the theme that you hear consistently is that our communities believe in the importance of local control. They certainly want some frameworks, but they like local controls. And I think as part of our bill, there's a whole concept of tight-loose, tight on the outcomes, but loose on how you implement them. And I think that's the opportunity for where you really get to have the local control. So I want to just tell you how it would work in Springfield. I'm not saying it would work the same way every place. We have been a district who prides ourselves on collaboration with our associations, and different districts might be as far along in this concept or still moving towards it. So certainly different districts would approach this a little bit differently. But I think in the end, it's going to take a high degree of collaboration that we're really all committed to. So I want to talk about a few things in the amendments and then just give you an example of how they could come about. The first and the last time I met with you, we really talked about that there would be a planning committee, a committee that would really look at the outcomes and how you're going to achieve those together. And those would be made up of members of the association, recommended by members of the associations. And by associations, I mean OEA, or in our case, it would be SEA, OSEA, who also works with like our instructional assistants who are in the classroom side by side working with the teachers, and our administrative associations. So that would be a group recommended by their associations who would work towards what do the outcomes, how would we achieve the targets we've set in the achievement compacts. Now, once we've done that work, it's very important to take that out to your community and talk to key people about what's an achievement compact? Why is it important? What are the targets? What are the strategy? And I call it zigzagging back and forth and getting their input. And Senator Beyer, I think you were involved in this when we did the Springfield Quality Ed model, but there's a number of things we would do. The first thing, in our district, we have a key communicator group. That's a group of about 400 key communicators. And how you get on the list is if you hear their name five or six times, you put it on the list. So my hairdresser is a great person to tell me about people in the community who care about schools because she cuts a lot of our hair. So she goes on the list, and all the people she's talked to who care goes on the list, along with people like Lee, who is one of our senators, and other community leaders. So we communicate with those 400 people all the time. We bring them together twice a year, and we would bring them together after our committee had done this work to get their input so we could take it back to the committee. Another thing we did with our Springfield Quality Ed model, which I thought worked exceptionally well, is we used existing infrastructure. So we went to all the Rotaries. They're always looking for a good program. We know that, right? And the Kiwanis clubs. We went to the city council. We went to as many of those groups that have regular meetings anyways, and we presented information about, in this case, it would be the achievement compact. In that case, it was about the vision for the school district. So we would zigzag out to all of these groups. Of course, there's site councils at our schools, there's PTAs, there's PTOs, and I have a student advisory committee of 25 students who advise me on everything I do, and talk about a tough group to be in front of. That's my that's a group who gives me the most honest and sincere feedback about what needs to happen in schools, because they're obviously students in schools. So as you're zigzagging out, you're explaining it, you're getting input, it would go back to the committee who would take that input and then would come up with what are the final strategies that we are going to implement, goals and strategies to achieve whatever the target is on the achievement compact. I can't tell you how important it is for us to have our associations, OEA, OSEA, and administrators with us on this work, because they're the ones who are going to implement it in the classrooms. And if people feel part of the process, empowered by the process, and understands the process, they will do a tremendous job. So that's the key. Now, the other piece in these amendments, it's talked about in C and D, is one thing that's going to be really critical is working with our professional organizations, and I'm talking about OEA, OSBA, COSA, OSEA, around coming forward with what do we need in terms of staff development to make sure everybody understands the achievement compacts, they have the support they need to implement the compact. All of these organizations provide staff development. As an administrator, COSA provides a lot of staff development for me. OSBA for the boards, OSEA for their classified people, and OEA for teachers. So I think together, if we come up with staff development that we need to effectively implement this, then everyone who is responsible to implement it will have the skills and knowledge they need to implement it. As you can see, it says on September 30th, 2012, they'll develop recommendations to the Oregon Education Investment Board about how do you create these collaborative models like I'm describing. Again, making sure that it fits with local communities, and also what are the resources that we need to put either by having these associations provided or additional resources to really provide the training people need to implement it effectively. So that's just one example of how we plan to proceed. It's very similar to that we've done before with lots of success. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll hold off on questions until we hear from...
And then if I could continue back to our list, we have listed an item in amendment number 6 on our list to provide more focus on achievement gaps. This was reflected in the sample achievement compact we shared with you on January 20th, but not clear enough in the statutory language. So we're proposing that we clarify that the goal setting shall apply to the disadvantaged student groups as well as to the student population as a whole, and that the targets and the reporting on those targets then reflect the each of the so-called subgroups, racial and ethnic groups, English language learners, students from poor and low-income families, and those who have special education needs. As reported now in the Oregon report card, these results for these groups will be reported as well in response to the achievement compacts and will allow local boards to be focused on setting appropriate targets for the disadvantaged student groups and allow the board to be informed by results for each of these groups as well. And lastly, we believe that we need a more explicit reference to the 40-40-20 goals that are in there by reference to a statute number, an ORS number. And we want to be more explicit in calling out the high school and college completion goals we've set for 2025 and capturing those on the achievement compacts so that each district is aware of where it stands now in relation to achieving those goals by 2025, how much distance is yet to be traveled, and can keep that in mind in setting its targets. This is where we also use the word trajectory. As you heard the governor use earlier, we want to make sure that we are establishing a trajectory that leads to the achievement of these ambitious goals for high school and college completion by the year 2025. All of these amendments, as I mentioned, have been worked on and approved by the Oregon Education Association, the Confederation of School Administrators, the Oregon School Board Association, the American Federation of Teachers, Stand for Children, and I may be leaving others out, and I'm sure others will be coming forward with their letters of support and endorsement. The important thing is to remember that this is related as well, as the governor said, to our hope for a successful waiver from the No Child Left Behind Act. We'd much rather be focused on these interventions as and this method of accountability than on what's likely to force us to spend $30 to $45 million in Title I funds in interventions that are not going to be as tailored to the needs of our students and as proven in their effectiveness as a lot of what our schools are doing now. This model, this achievement compact, is a method for us to be able to compare and improve, find those districts with comparable student populations, find what's working there, and bring those improvements to districts with similar student populations. That's the idea. It will require educator engagement, as Nancy described. It will also require improvement over time. It will be the initial year of achievement compacts. We're asking all education entities to adopt their targets and their compacts at the time they adopt their budgets this spring for the 12-13 fiscal year. That's by June 30th. That's just a baseline setting year. The real work begins thereafter with the processes they each put in place to achieve these goals, which then inform the targets they set and the achievement compacts they adopt in subsequent years. It's important to us, however, both because we want to launch this process and not waste any of the remaining 13 years between now and 2025. We want to get this underway, but also because the No Child Left Behind waiver process requires us to be setting targets for accountability purposes in the next school year. We can't let a year go by for that purpose as well. I hope this explains the legislation and the amendments. With me as well is Morgan Anderson from the Oregon Business Association, and I think she wants to comment as well.
Thank you so much, Chair Hash, members of the committee. As Tim said, I'm Morgan Anderson. I do chair OBA's Education Committee. I'm also an employee at Intel. I've worked nearly 15 years in K-12 and higher ed there, looking for avenues to help improve student achievement across the state of Oregon. And Oregon Business Association and Intel both support Senate Bill 1581. We do feel that this legislation will improve the lives of Oregon students and their families and position our state for future economic growth. This bill addresses achievement compacts, which we've heard a lot about, and we've heard about the tight, loose relationship that this provides, that the state will be tight on the outcomes it expects from the education institution, but loose on the how. How it will be determined by the local institution at the local level. The achievement compacts foster two-way accountability between the state and the education institutions in setting and achieving educational goals. These goals establish a mechanism to foster prioritization and budgeting at the local level, whereby local communities, with input from a wide range of stakeholders, would be encouraged to connect their budgets to goals and outcomes. The achievement compacts will allow the state to understand what outcomes it can expect with each dollar invested. In addition, it will provide a basis for comparisons of outcomes and progress within districts and between districts with comparable student populations. This will allow us to learn from best-known methods. It would identify efficiencies as well as leverage opportunities for higher achievement across students. This legislation also requires that the six education executives, including the early childhood director, the deputy superintendent of public instruction, the community college commissioner, the OUS chancellor, the executive director of the Student Access Commission, and the executive director of the Higher Ed Coordinating Council, will serve under the direction of the chief education officer. And we feel this reporting structure is essential to ensuring alignment of purpose and for bringing all aspects of education to a streamlined administration structure. While much work has been put into place to better align our education system, we still have significant gaps. Ensuring that all education entities receive oversight from the Chief Education Officer and the Oregon Education Investment Board will greatly improve alignment and ensure that every dollar invested will not be duplicated or wasted. Having spent all but 3 years of my life living and working in Oregon, there are two things in my lifetime that has not changed. One is the realization that we do not have enough money for education, and the other is that there's no end to the silos in education. And this bill does not solve the challenge of limited resources, and that is going to be a critical conversation to have. But what it does do is it allows the state to know how the money we do invest will directly link to our educational goals. And secondly, we will have alignment and structure and management of our pre-K through 20 system. And this provides hope that the words silo and education will be a thing of the past, something that I think we all would like to see. We just had the Oregon graduation rates released, and we saw a slight uptick. We went from 66% graduation rate to 67% graduation rate. While it's the right direction, 33% of our students still are facing a very, very bleak future. Our state cannot afford a system that leaves one-third of our students locked out of the knowledge economy. Senate Bill 1581 provides velocity to achieving our education aspirations of 40-40-20. Now, I work at Intel, and we broke ground on D1X, the world's most complex semiconductor factory in the world, in February 2011, and it's going to be completed this summer, 2012. 18 months. In 18 months, we will have a 200,000 square foot factory built. And I can tell you that it's on schedule. That's good news. And we know that it's on schedule because we know how every dollar we invest, where it's going, and each bill we pay, we know why and what outcome we received. And it's on schedule because Intel has an aligned management structure, and we're all working towards the same goal, getting that building up and getting it operational. But clearly, education and semiconductor factories are very, very different entities, and the metaphors may not be very useful. But the Silicon Forest is here in Oregon, and I can tell you it is thriving. And we are going to need educated employees to fill our factory and fill our jobs. We believe Senate Bill 1581, with all the amendments that Tim went through, provides the framework to better serve Oregon students and put them on a pathway to a successful education and a successful career. And that's why OBA and Intel support this bill, and we urge your support as well.
Okay, thank you. I think we have a couple of questions here. I'd like to start with Dr. Golden. You've done some of this in Springfield, and you have on this amendment asking districts to set up achievement compact committees. Is that what you have done? And I know everybody sounds like they agree to that, but some of us up here in the past have been reluctant to ask districts to do more things. And so I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure. You know, what you're asking us to do is to get together and meet around what's most important, which is how we're going to meet outcomes for students. That's our craft. You know, when you bring teachers together and instructional assistants and say, what do you think you need to do to get kids to meet these outcomes? That doesn't seem like work to people. That seems like being empowered to do getting a voice in the work you're going to do anyways. I think we prefer that to just being told you're going to do this and not being able to give input to it or have the training to do it. So I think people look at this as a natural cycle of the very important professional work we do.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Barr.
It's more of a comment. I've watched Superintendent Golden do this in Springfield, and I was sitting here thinking, you know, it's education, like everything else, is really trendy, and really mostly what we're talking about here is what we've been calling for years continuous improvement plans or products. And I know I've watched Nancy do that in a couple of the elementary schools. We're sitting down with the staff and saying, we're not hitting it here. Tell me what you're going to do. And the staff would put together the compact, if you will, said, here's how we're going to get there. And then the school board monitors it and say, you know, do that. I would envision that within Springfield School District, you may not have a formal compact, but you have something like it that would tie up to the top on that. In my mind, you know, the words are nice and all of this stuff, but what really makes it work, and the only thing that will make it work, is if the people who are actually going to get the job done are involved in creating the goals, making this. Too much of the time in the past, we focused on tests, and it's been kind of a negative thing that if you don't do this, you're going to get fired kind of stuff, and that rarely ever works in management. And so I think this is going in the right direction, and to me, what's really important is that the teachers and the staff, the people who have to make this thing work, are really involved, along with the parents, in saying this is what we want to get done. And at the end of the day, we have some accountability back to the state, if you will. It's providing the people that are providing the money, saying this is what you said you were going to do in Springfield School District or Salem School District, and did you get there or not, rather than trying to key off of some silly national test that really doesn't tell you much about anything. One of my frustrations in watching No Child Left Behind is we had school districts in my community, not just Springfield, but others, that were making quantum leaps forward in performance, and yet, because they didn't make a certain thing, they were listed as a non-performing school, which was sort of ridiculous. So I think this is a better way to go, but I want to emphasize that I think it's all about working with the employees and empowering them to put the goals together and come up with the right metrics that you can measure it. Because I think it's important that you have metrics to do that. So,
Senator Beyer, I think one thing you said that's very important is that we have applied for a waiver from No Child Left Behind. And the only way to obtain that waiver, of course, we want to be accountable, but the federal government is saying you have to have something to show us what you're measuring. So this Achievement Compact is really going to help us obtain a waiver that allows whatever the measurement is to make a lot more sense to our local communities and I think our state in general. So it's critical for that reason, too.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the Achievement Compacts, and if you have a local school district and a board that is just totally dysfunctional. I won't mention the district. It happens to be my hometown. But we went through a period in that community when it was an embarrassment and the kids were suffering. How would this investment board and how would it function when you have a failing governance structure within a district?
Yeah. Senator Haas, Senator Morris, I think I can begin to see, and of course we're thinking out, you know, this is the beginning, the initial part of this, but I know that COSA or OSBA is going to work with boards to really help boards know what their role is to really achieve these achievement compacts. And so I think you have to rely on the professional organizations to really help boards to develop the skills that they need so they do function in a way that they're really focused on the outcomes and helping students get there. I think this also focuses some of the work of boards because I think sometimes I've seen school boards that dip a little too low or they're involved in things which is really not the policy level work that they're elected to do. So just like we're going to need to provide support to the teachers, and I know OSBA can do this in their work and working side by side with COSA, who will work with superintendents. I mean, quite honestly, as a superintendent, if the school board in Springfield's not functioning well, I think that's part of my problem as a superintendent, because I need to have the skill to work effectively with my board so they can work effectively with children. So I think COSA is going to need to work very closely on this, too.
Thank you. As a follow-up.
Sure.
And I want to make it abundantly clear that the district I'm referring to is an entirely different district today.
Got it. Yes.
Okay. Different leadership, but
I followed the history, so I know.
Yeah. Right. but it did cause me to actually go to legislative council and think about if you have an underperforming school board, which is elected, and you have the total dysfunction within that district, you know, how do you resolve that? And we came up with no answer, and really, how you do resolve that. And so I'm curious how this might treat that situation differently.
Do you know, as the governor's alternate on the Oregon Education Investment Board, I think partly how we feel on the board is a lot of this questions like that would be very important questions for the Oregon Education Board to think about along with legislators. I mean, the point is, we have to work towards getting the outcomes students need to be successful. And so, you know, I think together you can really start figuring out how you make that work. I mean, the district you're talking about eventually did figure out a way to make it work.
And they're doing great.
Yes.
But
yes.
There was a period of time when it was just a mess.
Right. Yeah, those are the questions we need to answer together.
Okay. Well, we'll make a date for a week from today.
Great.
And we'll see you then. And appreciate you coming forward and walking us through this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to continue our informational hearing and moving now to Senate Bill 1538. And to help us go through that is Bridget Burns from the Oregon University System. And Tim, if you could join us to weigh in. Thank you.
Chair
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. Today I'm going to be here to talk to you about Senate Bill 1538, which is a follow-up piece of legislation that improves upon and makes some slight changes post the adoption of Senate Bill 242, which I'm going to go through just a little bit of brief history, give you some high-level context for this legislation, do a flyover of what's contained, and I think that the remaining questions that that are raised by this piece of legislation are pertaining to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, namely, you know, what do we need to do, why do we need it, and why is it different than the Oregon Education Investment Board and the State Board of Higher Education or governance in general. So it will just be quick, and I know you want to be out here by 2:30, so I will commit to doing that. So just a brief background, Senate Bill 242 came about as a result of an interim legislative work group that was bipartisan, bicameral, and was implemented last year, and we're just now on the heels of having implemented the major portion of that, which is the status change from state agency to public university system. Now, that happened on January 1. I know you all were celebrating the new year, but I was really celebrating this part, which was that we're no longer treated like any other state agency, like ODOT or DAS. And that comes with it a lot of additional obligations for us to work even harder, but at the same time, it makes running universities a little bit easier for us. We're going to have a little bit more flexibility to be able to better manage our costs. Some of those changes that took place January 1 included that we're no longer overseen by the Department of Justice. We had to bring on additional legal teams to be able to help out with all of our universities, and we've done that. We're establishing new tuition processes on the campuses that are really steeped in having students be part of that process. We're now able to retain interest that's earned on tuition. When students and their parents give us their tuition money, now any money that's earned from that in terms of interest, we retain and use 100% of that for need-based aid on our campuses. And we're no longer a state agency, and we also have flexibility pertaining to expenditure limitation. So that was a lot of work that was done, but there were some questions still that stood there in terms of the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And that's what Senate Bill 1538 is working to do, is to clarify the relationship between the OEIB and the HEC. You know, with 242 and Senate Bill 909 coming about at the same time, and there's been so much great work done in the interim by the Oregon Education Investment Board on the ideas of achievement compacts, this is about figuring out where those go in terms of authority and such. The second part of this bill is that it expands and further details what kind of coordination functions will be housed at the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And the third part is there's a minor Treasury technical amendment that was something that we intended to put in 242 and needed to be followed up. And I can talk about that if you have questions, but it's just a minor issue in terms of they need to no longer have to flag, including OUS. If they make any changes in Treasury, they don't have to say OUS. It's included in all other agencies. The fourth is that it transfers responsibility for the data system to the OEIB. So that's what you have before you in terms of Senate Bill 1538, which again is just following up for 242. I'll just talk briefly about what the need for the HEC is and what role it's going to fill and where the urgency comes from. The reason this matters right now is that there are still some outstanding questions, and the HEC is set to be created on July 1. Now, there are some concerns because we don't have staffing yet or funding for the entity. But right now, what takes place for coordination takes place at the Joint Boards Working Group. Now, the Joint Boards is an entity that is, it's not really prescriptive, it's more a convener, which is what the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission is going to be. It's about things that transcend the educational entities, that transcend the boundaries that exist right now. So it's not specifically about OUS or the community colleges or the independent universities or OHSU. It's more focused on the in-between, transferability, dual credit, student-focused initiatives for students of color or underrepresented communities. It's going to include the Office of Degree Authorization. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission will be housed there. Programs like Aspire, things that kind of transcend any of these different entities, right? But they're all about just students. That's what's going to be at the HEC. It's going to be about facilitating greater coordination, sharing best practices, but being kind of a clearinghouse support for folks who work regardless of what enterprise you're working in post-secondary. But it won't be prescriptive, and it's also going to have a lot of to do with transfer and articulation policies. So the way I like to look at it is this entity is going to be looking at the 80%. You know, when we talk about the 40-40-20, it's going to not just focus on the 40%, which is certificates and community college degrees, and not just the 40% for bachelor's, but it's going to look at the whole enterprise. And this is important because, you know, at OUS, we care about the 40% that we're focused on, but the truth is we don't comprise all of that. OHSU, independent colleges and universities, I mean, to meet all of the educational needs in Oregon, we need all of our entities. And so the HEC is really going to think about the 80% and think about how we can help our students move in that pipeline, how they can have better experiences, you know, and it's also going to, frankly, be a commission for you all. If you ever have questions about higher education or post-secondary, that would be the place that you could easily get answers. For instance, Representative Dembro is very passionate about textbook prices. That would be something you would want to go to the HEC about, because it would look at not just OUS, not just the community colleges, but independent institutions, and just the costs that are shared by students regardless of where they sit. So it's frequently referred to as very similar to the joint boards, which it's true, because the joint boards is going to stop existing on June 30th. But the difference is the joint boards right now is staffed by CCWD and OUS kind of helping out each other, but there isn't really any dedicated staff. So when you created the HEC, what you were trying to do is you saw the great things going on with the joint boards, and you wanted to create some infrastructure around it to create actual support for it so that it was a freestanding entity and be able to provide all those outstanding services that the joint boards currently does, but also have the Office of Degree Authorization and, for instance, OSAC, just kind of those things that transcend the educational entities. So, and if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt. So that's what the HEC was intended to be. It was about students and their experiences, and it's not about governance. There's a very strong difference between what coordination is and what governance is, and also what the OEIB is going to be doing. In my mind, the OEIB is essentially kind of a ways and means process for education. It's identifying one budget for all the education enterprise and going to deal with it so there won't be any competition amongst education sectors when they come before you. And they're also going to be doing so many transformational things that are really exciting. So that's very separate from governance. Governance is about day-to-day operation, running the institution, making sure it's the best it can be. And frequently, we're all working on whether you have a local board, a local university institutional board, a central governing board, it's about day-to-day operation, it's about fiduciary responsibility, it's about, you know, risk management, relationships with employees and things like that. Those are not at all the coordination stuff I'm talking about with the HEC. They are, frankly, things that are critical, and so critical that sometimes we don't have time to think about these coordination, really critical components that once the HEC is fully adopted, it will really help us with our day jobs. And that's kind of how I view the HEC, is that, you know, I work on behalf of the 7 public universities in Oregon, and I love to work collaboratively with my partners in the community colleges and independent colleges and universities. But sometimes there's so much on my plate that I don't have time to focus on all the things that we could be collaborating on. And the HEC will be a resource where I could pick up the phone and ask any question I need to. If I have an institution that wants to develop a stronger pipeline for students who are interested in one career track, I could call up the HEC and they would tell me what community colleges in this state or what independent universities are also interested in that and what they might have learned along the way. They would also probably know about things that have gone on in other states, different innovative ideas that they've adopted. So it wouldn't be telling me what to do, but giving me resources and a way to support the work that's currently ongoing. So I hope that I've been able to shed a little bit of light on the difference there. In my mind, they're very different. I realize they're ongoing governance conversations, from the way that I look at it, I think that the HEC kind of transcends that and is about something totally different, regardless of what decisions are made. And it's something that will be a valuable resource for us, regardless of where you sit working on post-secondary issues. It's really going to help us work with even students in high schools, because it will deal with dual credit as well. So that's just a flyover of what's in Senate Bill 1538. I hope that I can answer any additional questions you might have, but hopefully we don't have any, because I've been so clear.
Tim Nesbitt, can you weigh in on how these
sure.
Live in harmony?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm Tim Nesbitt, the manager of the Oregon Education Investment Project for the governor. And it appears that we had two bills on separate courses last session, both kind of reached port at the same time, and we threw a line from one to the other and said we'd figure it out later exactly how they're better coordinated. And here we're just trying to make sure we have the best lines of communication and lines of functionality between the HEC and the Oregon Education Investment Board and the processes surrounding them. I think Bridget Burns captured well the purposes and the need for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Just a couple of principles we would offer, because we've made some attempts to draft language which started to kind of crumble under its own weight, I have to admit. So we decided to go back and just say, here are a couple of principles important to us. One is to provide for timely advice from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to the Oregon Education Investment Board and to the legislature, because we know that's a path of advice that you want to create on state budget allocations for post-secondary, including the Oregon Student Access Commission budget. They all relate to our post-secondary completion goals, our 40-40-20 goals, and we think the Higher Education Commission, as Bridget already said, can add a lot of value to discussions about these system-wide issues, such as achievement of our 40-40-20 goals and the coordination or articulation of degree programs, something the Joint Boards has already had success with, and access and affordability. So a process that's timely to provide advice to the OEIB, to the legislature around the budget, those will be different timelines. Those can work with advice to the OEIB by September of an even-numbered year. That works fine.
Okay.
Secondly, advice from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to the OEIB on what we were talking about in the previous bill, the goals, outcomes, and targets to be expressed in achievement compacts for our post-secondary institutions. That would be valuable to advice to have. That would be advice to the OEIB, since they're the ones who draw up under this legislation. Under the other legislation, they're the ones that would draw up the achievement compacts and be the parties to achievement compacts. That would be a different timeline. That would probably be most beneficial in the first quarter of a given calendar year, because those achievement compacts are going to be put in place on the budget process for each educational entity. With that, we want to call to your attention one other problem to be solved, and that is with programs being transferred to the HEC, for instance, the Office of Degree Authorization, and I think maybe the Department of Ed Career Schools is part of this. There is not yet funding for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, not yet funding for its executive officer. We've suggested, and we'd be open to having the chief education officer, who will be on board by July 1 when the HEC is established, to assume the duties of the executive officer of the HEC in the event of such a vacancy. And it may be that it will take until the next biennium for the funding to come forward that would enable the hiring of an executive officer for the HEC. The problem is compounded by the fact that, yes, programs could move over to the HEC, but then even to enter into an intergovernmental agreement where the HEC would be paying for the staff work being now done by OSAC or the Department of Ed, you'd need an executive officer, kind of as an agency head, to enter into an intergovernmental agreement. So we could be maybe solving a couple of problems with this one approach here by clarifying the chief education officer's interim authority to take on these duties. Not to serve in two positions, that creates other legal problems, but simply take on these duties. And finally, I do want to note, as the governor mentioned in response to Senator Morse's question earlier, there is an ongoing effort launched by the investment board and to be led by the chief education officer, to look at this design and organization of the P20 system, focus on form following function, streamlining the decision making, limiting the number of boards, and the specific directive adopted by the and I can actually pass out copies here for the resolution adopted by the OEIB, specifically to arrive at one entity for the direction and coordination of the university system, and also recommend a single coordinated structure to carry out the functions which are now arrayed across these post-secondary agencies. And that is something which we think will be brought to clearer focus by the end of this year and will, I think, further affect recommendations you might receive in 2013 for the role of the HEC, the role of the Higher Ed Board, and the role of other commissions, for instance, OSAC, in a better coordinated P20 system, specifically the post-secondary phase of that P20 system. So I hope that's helpful.
It is. It's just, you know, we are definitely in the weeds here with both of these policy bills, and we're now working within the parameters, I think, of those things. And this is, in some ways, the harder part. We use the analogy tax reform. Everybody's for tax reform, but when you start saying, okay, well, this capital gains, sales tax, that's when it starts to get more difficult. Senator Byer, did you have a question?
I'm very pleased to hear your last comment that you're making. I think that this is a very difficult task of merging two different policy ideas and an existing administrative structure, and it sort of mixes administration and policy, and I'm sympathetic to the job you've done. I think you've sort of done the best you can of breaking a couple of eggs and putting something together, and I think the comment that the governor made earlier, Tim, and yours about this is a work that needs to happen over time. I think the role that the 242 laid out for the HEC is a very important role in the state. I'm not completely sure why it's separate from OEIB or should be. I mean, functionally there. One of the things that strikes me is we have an opportunity in the next couple of years, maybe going to 2013, of reorganizing. We've sort of been working on reorganizing the policy structure for education, and then we've got to have to function on the administrative side and separate that out. And maybe with the change of the Office of Superintendent of Public Instructions, we can take a new look at what should a Department of Education look like. And I'm thinking more on the technical side. The idea of using the Chief Education Officer as the CAO, if you will, for both organizations is a step in the right direction to start clearing up some of the lines that Senator Morris was talking about before. I think that's important to clean that up, and I see a real distinction between administering programs and setting policy. The policy is the board's work and supported by the staff, but the board doesn't need to be getting into the weeds on doing scholarships and that sort of thing. I think we do need a good structure to do that, and I suspect that we can probably save some money, although that's not the chief goal here. Educating Oregonians is the chief goal. But so, you know, I see some problems in the bills, but it may be the best we can do in this session, recognizing that it's a work in progress.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know we're in an informational hearing on one bill, but I'd like to ask a question that kind of wraps around both of these.
We're on both. So.
Oh, we're still on both.
Yeah.
Okay, good. We've created the vision, and have we mapped this to the extent of a business plan and a financial pro forma to actually see what the cost of this vision is compared to where we are today, and redirecting resources, what additional costs may be on the table?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, we have not completed the mapping. We have taken as more than a operating principle on faith, but an operating principle informed by people we've talked to that have done these plans, that we should be able to free up resources to better support teaching and learning generally by doing this alignment. And with the existing resources as the box within which we're working, that is what's so motivating about this. We think when we talk about the state's role in building a P20 system, A, it has to happen at the state level. This is where we construct the funding formulas. This is where we make policy decisions at the highest level, but in partnership with our education entities, we then have to be talking about coordination and support. And you hear those needs expressed. I think Superintendent Golden, when she talked about professional development, some of that, and certainly when we talk about our teacher education programs in universities, has got to be a focus, and it's one which starts at the state level, perhaps with guidance from the OAIB. The again, streamlining and consolidation sounds good. Decision-making should be more effective. But the real goal here is freeing up resources. We would hope we would have, for instance, a Department of Education that's less compliance-focused and better able to support education in our school districts. We hear that a lot from superintendents.
Just as a follow-up, it seems like so often that policy changes are additive, and they're not redirecting. And the encouragement that I would give and the things that I would be looking for would be, of the existing resources that we have, how do we redirect them more effectively and not create new departments, new agencies, new... I mean, I think you hear what I'm saying.
Thank you, Senator. That is our goal.
Senator Byers.
One additional. I hope that we put the resources, as we shift the responsibility for certifying or licensing, whatever, some of these private schools behind that. I know how the system used to work about 30 years ago when I did a lot of that work, licensed those. I don't know how it is today, but I have a growing concern. I know this is a national problem with some private schools starting up, and I'm not opposed to private schools, but some of them starting up and people, as they're out of work, trying to get into them, but spending an awful lot of money going through programs that they think will lead to success, and they find out that they virtually have no value at all in the marketplace. Oregon used to be pretty tough on that, and had some really good private business schools, they called them then, and some others. I'm a little concerned about where we're at today with some of those.
Senator Beyer, I can respond to that. The Office of Degree Authorization in Oregon, we're known around the country for having some of the strongest regulations pertaining to issues like that. And it's particularly drawing a lot of attention right now because the federal government is devoting a lot of energy towards for-profit institutions. There's a real crackdown that's been going on, especially in Washington, D.C., and they consistently are looking at some of the language that we use and the way that we've been dealing with this for a long time. We've had some outstanding administrators at the Office of Degree Authorization that write all the time for national publications. I mean, this is kind of, diploma mills don't feel comfortable setting up here, but that, and we're seen as kind of an example, but I think you're hitting on an important point.
I'm not as concerned about the diploma mills, although that's certainly an issue. Some of them were more trade schools. I'm not sure that, and I'm could be completely off base, have a place where a citizen could go to today and say, I'm thinking about getting training in this. What's the performance record of the institution? Do people who get this certificate or degree, can they really use it and get jobs? Is it respect in the community? It's a hard task to fulfill that, but I think it's important.
Senator Beyer, that would members of the committee, I think that would also seem like something that would directly be tied to audit. You know, at the Oregon University System, we audit all of our universities. We can talk to you about, we're spending a lot more time trying to better understand the employment rates of all of our graduates and where we're successful and where we're not. But we focus primarily on OUS institutions. Right. Statewide, I'm not really sure where you would look for that information, but it seems like it would be tied to audit.
All right. Well, thank you both. Next point say on this bill as well, a full and open public hearing with notice. There will be some amendments to this bill to clarify a couple of dates and some issues are relating to oversight on community colleges. So we'll have some amendments on this as well. Thank you both. I'll close our informational hearing. And committee, just for purposes of homework, we have a omnibus education bill that is up for next Monday that has five or six issues on there, none of which are really controversial, but given the length of this session, it would be my intent to hear that bill and vote on it that same day on Monday. Just to try and keep on track.
and hear these bills and vote on them on Wednesday.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might, whatever, I don't know if we expect amendments to that. I know one of the problems we're going to have in this short session is, like, we had a really good summary of amendments we expect to have, but we don't have the amendments. Yeah. Will we add the amendments we're going to be voting on beforehand? I assume we will.
I hope so.
Absolutely. We absolutely will.
We're not Congress, Mr. Chair.
And I know it's not Victoria's job to do the amendments.
Well, we had hoped to have, I'll say this, we had hoped to have amendments for these bills today and didn't, so
okay.
We do what we can. These guys are just, you know, you could appreciate the bottleneck.
Yeah. Now, we're putting a lot of pressure on the staff across the board, and yeah. I know. I respect that. It's just sort of not sure how we deal with it.
Okay. Thank you. And we are adjourned.
Why this session feels so much